introduction and thank you for having me here. I'm really excited to present on this topic. So I'll just go over that introduction again. I work at the clinical and research program at MGH focused on depression. So that really speaks to the job that I have. I provide individual therapy to people of all ages, children, adolescents, and adults with both mood and anxiety disorders. And a large part of my job is conducting research too. I'm really interested in how our automatic thoughts or interpretations about life events impact things like depression and other difficulties. And this led me to actually be really interested in this type of intervention or type of therapy called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is the basis for this presentation today. So what I'm going to start with is define mindfulness and place it within a context, and then discuss different interventions that might incorporate this approach. My goal is to be as helpful as possible today, so there's going to be some time for discussion at the end, but I'd be open to questions as we go throughout, and I'll try to take some breaks to see if there's any points of clarification or more information. But before I'd really like to go into things, I'd be really eager to hear what you know about mindfulness, if there's any thoughts on this. Has anybody experienced any mindfulness before? Excellent. So you're going to be a good resource here. Anybody else? What do people know about mindfulness?
I have a meditation practice.
Okay. So this is going to sound familiar.
Live in the moment.
So there's a big present moment focus, which I'm gonna talk about. So it sounds like a lot of people have had some experience with mindfulness, which is great. So some of this might be a review. So I'd like to just give you an overview of different treatment options and different things that can be helpful. But what I would like to do is actually start at the very beginning of humankind. So let's take us back to Pangaea, back when all the continents were together. We were not yet the human species as we are today. And I'd like to pose a question to you. You know, why did we survive as a species? We're not very fast. We're not particularly strong. We don't have, sharp teeth or claws. So why did we survive when, there's all these predators around?
Intellect,
so our minds, that's a big one. Any other thoughts?
Opposable thumbs,
and that allowed us to use tools. Excellent.
I didn't know where we're coming from.
Perceptual thinking?
Conceptual thinking,
absolutely.
Fight or flight
response, communication. All of these are great. You know, we're also a social being, but we're not the only animals that's social. A number of other animals use tools as well, but it is our mind, our ability to think abstractly, that I'd like to suggest really allowed us to survive. It's our brains that really were more developed, so we could actually think about things that weren't there. So back then, let's say sub-Sahara Africa, the most dangerous place to be was the watering hole. All animals needed to go get water, and the predators know this as well. So the predators are hanging out there. Animals go there, they rely upon their instincts or their natural resources to survive. So we wouldn't be able to do that. So back in, let's say, the caves that we lived in, we were able to think about when might be the best time to go to the watering hole so we would be able to survive. So we could imagine this there and plan and problem solve around. So our minds are our greatest resource here that allowed us to survive throughout this time. So flash forward to today. We're no longer under physical threat. There aren't any tigers or alligators there to get us, but our minds are still working as they are. They're still our greatest source of strength. However, our minds are now turned to other types of vulnerability. Pain and discomfort is the new target, and our minds are geared or designed to protect us against those things. So we're no longer adapting to our environment. We've adapted our environment to ourselves, but our minds are still working as they should. Now, and that brings us to part of the dark side of our language and our minds. So we think to ourselves in terms of language, and language is quite a powerful thing. Our minds are always trying to protect us, again, against pain and discomfort. And what it's turned to is pain and discomfort from different things that might bring us emotional pain. So we might make comparisons of ourselves to others. We might ruminate over past mistakes or past deeds. We might worry and project that worry into the future. And this leads to things like the development of depression or anxiety. So back in the cave, when we were thinking about the lion or the alligator, our bodies would respond with fight or flight response. Our heart rate would increase. Our digestion would stop. This happens today when we are worrying or ruminating about life events. Our bodies are reacting like that, and our stress system reacts as well. And I think this really speaks to how we can, you know, live in a different time than we are in the present moment. I think this quote really stood out to me as something that was really helpful to highlight this. So I'm just going to read this to you all. So the quote says, "First, I was dying to finish high school and start college. And then I was dying to finish college and start working. And then I was dying to marry and have children. And then I was dying for my children to grow old enough for school so I can return to work. And then I was dying to retire. And now I'm dying, and suddenly I realize I forgot to live." And to me, this quote really speaks to the idea that we might not be living in the here and now. We're living in a future tense, or we're living in the past. Our minds are geared toward protect us, but it comes at a cost. So as Barry had mentioned, there's a big focus on contact with the present moment. Our minds are geared to protect us, to fix the unwanted things to happen in the future, to fix the what-ifs, to undo past mistakes. And to have a physical metaphor, imagine that you're in a room of your life, and you have one door against, or one hand against a door about future problems, and then, if I didn't have this mic, one hand against the door of your past mistakes. And if I asked you to do anything in that room, how effective do you think you'd be at that? Not very effective. It'd be hard to manage the day-to-day tasks. And that's what our minds are constantly doing, constantly, you know, holding off things that might happen and preventing or thinking about things that happened in the past. So we lose the precious nows by always being in a different time. And I'd like to suggest that we only have the present. We only have the here and now. So we need to actually work against the way that our minds, you know, are geared to. And this gets us to what mindfulness is, which is a different stance of being. So this is a quote by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was one of the developers of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and mindfulness-based stress reduction. And he calls mindfulness, it means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. And I'll say that again. Mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. So there's a lot there, but I think each one of these components can enhance or combat some of that, you know, that our instinctual minds process. I'll go into this in a little bit. So being in the moment. So it is working against being in a different time. It's working against looking into the future, which can be helpful at times, but can sometimes be an overdrive. It's working against thinking about past mistakes or things that have happened in the past. It's really focused on the here and now. It's taking a stance of observing and noticing as opposed to judging, which is something that our minds do quite often. It's using our senses, being fully in the moment versus thinking about things constantly. And it's the opposite of being mindless. So an example of that is I used to... It took me about 30 minutes to get to work every day. I'd get off the highway, go from home, get on the highway, get there in 30 minutes or so. And after about a year, I would just get in the car and I'd wind up at work. I wouldn't be driving dangerously, but I'd just get there and realize, oh wait, you know, I'm here now. I don't know if anybody's had that experience. I would be thinking about what I'm going to do that day. I'd be thinking about, you know, what might happen over the weekend. But I would be just, in many ways, an autopilot. And that is the opposite of being mindful. Now, some different things that we do in our day-to-day might bring about a more contact with the present moment or bring about mindfulness. Now that the weather's nice, we can be out in nature, go for a hike. I don't know where she went. Go for a hike. Do things that we really enjoy to do. When we're rushed, it's often really hard to be in the present moment. When we're multitasking, it's really hard to have mindfulness. There's a really famous psychologist named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, a mouthful of a name, but he developed this ideal called flow. He interviewed people in the pinnacle of their careers, the best composers, the best dancers, the best athletes, and he did a narrative interview and asked them to describe the thing that they love, their passion. And there was a theme throughout their discussion. They described this experience of being so immersed in the now that other things would just fall away. And then what he realized was that it's not just these people in the pinnacle of their careers that could have this experience, it's everyday people like me and you. And to him, this is what being happy meant. Happiness means, to him, being more in the contact in those moments, having more flow. And at the bottom here, there's some interesting different things that we can do, like exercise and yoga and tai chi, that I'm going to talk about a little bit later that can actually also bring about this stance or a part of mindfulness. Now, what are some times that we can be the opposite of mindful? Going on autopilot, as I mentioned, being in driving to work. When we're rushing or multitasking, as you can see, some of these are the opposite of what brings about mindfulness. Being in front of the screen or drinking too much alcohol. For example, I get home from work, I'm tired, throughout the course of my day, and I might turn on the TV, and then all of a sudden it's time to go to bed. That couple of hours, that precious time, almost just goes by so quickly that because I'm just absorbing what's on the TV. Other things like doing things that are habitual, we might snack or eat a lot when we don't even notice that we've just finished the bag of chips. So those are times that we might be less mindful. So now I'm going to go into a few different interventions that incorporate mindfulness, but I'd like to just take a pause to see if anybody had any questions on some things that I reviewed. No?
Okay. You, I think, said precious, embrace the precious moment.
Mm-hmm.
What if that moment in the here and now is one of unremitting despair? How do you identify that as precious?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's something I fight against.
Absolutely. So the question was, what if the here and now present moment is despair? What if it's not a moment that you might want to be in right now? And that's a great question. I think it's finding the moments within that despair. There could be some variability, some times that are you might be less down, or times that within that period that could be the ones that you want to hold your hat on. I don't have a great answer for you for that, but I think that there are times that you might be able to identify that might be better. And it's those that we might want to increase or try to focus on. But we can talk a little bit more about that later. Anybody else?
What about Les Havens?
Excuse me, sorry?
Les Havens, the doctor.
I'm not familiar with Les Havens.
Not? Okay.
Sorry. So some of these third wave or newer psychotherapies incorporate mindfulness. And I'd like to just get a raise of hand of who's experienced or been in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. I have a number of people. Okay, so this might be familiar. How about ACT, or acceptance and commitment therapy? Okay, excellent. And dialectical behavioral therapy. Okay, so my guess is a lot of this you'll hear before or have experienced. I'm going to go over the first two, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is a group-based intervention, and acceptance and commitment therapy, which is generally an individual therapy. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is a group intervention that really combines two long-standing traditions, one of cognitive therapy, which is from the West, Western world, and Eastern meditative practice, which is from the East. And Jon Kabat-Zinn developed this in order to prevent recurrences or relapses of depression. Something that we know is that at times, depression can be episodic, and sometimes people who have experienced depression might also have a recurrence within their lifetime. So his goal was to reduce this recurrence. And so his goal was also to combat our minds and combat some of these negative self-thoughts. And so it's a group-based intervention that occurs about 8 weeks. Each session lasts between an hour and a half and 2 hours and goes through a series of exercises or practices to try to increase or incorporate mindfulness. This is done through a number of techniques like sitting meditations, body scans, as well as some education about depression or the disorder that's being treated. It develops action plans to increase those times that you might be able to be mindful. And there's actually a lot of homework that's been asked of people. You know, the idea is to commit to really developing the muscle, which is this mindful muscle. And this can be done both formally and informally. So formal practice might be doing a seated meditation or a body scan every day. Informal practice might be going for a mindful walk or eating mindfully. It's the day-to-day activities that are just done in a different way, intentionally and on purpose.
Explain body scan.
So a body scan is a technique that asks people to go through and focus on different parts of their body and spend some time really noticing how that might be. Now, a goal of a body scan or some of these others are to develop a different type of attentional awareness. And this attentional awareness can be focused both internally, but can also be focused on the outside world. The focus can be on our thoughts and our mind and how our minds work. And so it's to develop the tool or the ability to shift our attentional focus on different aspects or different events in our life. So the goal is to create this meta-cognitive awareness, the awareness of our thoughts, the awareness of this process in a different way. And it's done, as I mentioned, through these techniques to develop attention throughout different aspects of our life in a different way. A very common exercise that's done is the raisin exercise, which it seems like a lot of people who've experienced DBT or mindfulness might know what that is, but it's asking to look at an object in our everyday life in a different way and see how something so casual or normal to us can be so different when we really focus on it in a different way. And through these techniques, this exercise, we develop this stance of self-compassion, this non-judgmental stance, something that we're very good about doing with other people that sometimes is really hard to do for ourselves. And being that I'm a researcher, I just want to go over a little bit of the evidence for why this is helpful. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy has been around for some time now, and there's been a number of studies that have shown that MBCT is effective at reducing the recurrence of depression for many people. And this graph just simply shows they followed I don't know how many people, but for over a year and a half, they followed individuals who their depression remitted. And they actually found that people who took antidepressant medication, so maintenance medication, or were in this mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for 2 weeks, or for 8 weeks, actually had the same amount of relapse. So this was just as effective as taking medication. Now, more and more, MBCT is actually being used to treat episodes of depression. So it's actually being treated for active symptoms as well. But it's not as well established as those for treating relapse. Now, mindfulness also has been in the popular press recently because some advances in our cognitive neuroscience have been able to show that there are actually differences in our brain due to mindfulness. But to back up a little bit, what they started to look at is groups of individuals who were like expert mindfulness, like mindfulness monks and meditative practitioners. And they compared those to people who had never had mindfulness before or done mindfulness. And they actually saw some brain differences between these two groups. But to really know if mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or mindfulness-based intervention made some changes, they actually had people randomized to either, have 8 weeks of nothing or 8 weeks of MBCT. And what they found was there's some suggestion that there are changes in different regions of our brain that are associated with attentional awareness, thinking about ourselves, and emotion regulation. So there is some hints or some beginning to have evidence this actually makes some functional and structural changes on our brain. What would be really interesting, though, is there's a certain region of our brains called the default mode network. This region is active when we're at rest. So we're just sitting around, not doing anything, no tasks, and this is the region that's actually active. There is some suggestion that there are mindfulness can change this region. So it's doing what it's actually saying it's doing. It's changing our mind wandering, changing the times that our minds are thinking about things in the future or thinking in the past. And I'm going to switch gear to talk a little bit about ACT, which also incorporates mindfulness. ACT is an individual therapy that uses acceptance and mindfulness processes and committed actions and behaviors to develop psychological flexibility. It's in the tradition of CBT, but instead of the focus of reducing symptoms, the focus is increasing a life worth living. So although a life worth living. So it talks about values and other components that we might want to increase as opposed to different components of our life that we might want to decrease. So it feels different than CBT. It has its own philosophies, own techniques, and different process of change. And I guess most people won't be able to see this, but it's got this fancy hexaflex is what they call it, which is a six-cornered process of change. The goal is really to live in the here and now and develop this stance of non-judgmental acceptance. So there's the components of that are very familiar with MBCT, this mindfulness stance. And then once one can be more connected to the here and now, one can also develop or clarify their values. So values are different than goals. Goals are things that you can achieve, getting an A on a paper, different types of things that you can mark. Values are more a chosen direction of life. I think of them as something on the horizon. You can always go towards that, but there's nothing to really say that you've reached that. Almost like when you retire, what would you like people to say about you? They were a good mentor, they were a really funny person, they were really active in their community. And then once you are able to identify some values, to have a committed action in the here and now, to live consistently with those values. So this approach called ACT incorporates mindfulness into the whole intervention because it's the basis or root through which change might occur. So I've reviewed two interventions that are delivered by mental health practitioners, but there's also a number of other things that you can do that aren't delivered by mental health practitioners that incorporate mindfulness or mindful awareness. The two that I'm going to go over actually are under study within our program. So we're really interested in these other interventions that might increase mindful awareness. So the first is yoga, and my guess is many people know what yoga is, and many people might have tried or done yoga before. But yoga takes on many different forms. It ranges in degree of physical intensity and spiritual focus, and is a body motions that relate to different stances in mindfulness breathing. In addition, Tai Chi is a moving meditation, with physical exercise wrapped in a dance-like position. Some misconceptions of what Tai Chi is. It's not an exercise for people who are older in the park. It's actually a really great kind of slow movements with breathing exercises to really capture a focus of the present moment. Now, why might these two different groups or these different interventions be helpful? Well, one way is that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy often asks people to stay seated and then do these mindfulness exercises. And when I was in mindfulness groups, I found that quite difficult because, my mind would be so powerful, it would really distract myself, or I'd think a lot about how my body, I felt uncomfortable. Now, these two different interventions decrease that uncomfortability or tension in one's body and really focus on the actions that one's doing. So it's a really helpful, it could be a helpful first vent into mindfulness practice. And exercise by itself has been shown to be helpful for one's mood or anxiety. So it's got the benefits of exercise, the benefits of mindfulness, and some yoga or Tai Chi specific benefits all wrapped into a package. And why might these work? It might work through an increase in our discipline or self-control of our bodies. Both of these have a focus on breathing and acceptance of oneself. And if you recall before, you know, our fight or flight response, when we, you know, are thinking about things that aren't in the here and now, our bodies are reacting as though they are there. And both yoga and Tai Chi have been shown to reduce our physiological arousal or reactivity. So it can be helpful in that sense. And while not as much evidence has been shown with depression, there is some research to suggest that both of these, both yoga and Tai Chi, can be helpful in treating one's mood, both as a standalone intervention or also on top or in addition to other types of treatments. And, you know, as I mentioned, we're currently conducting these studies to see if this can be useful for people. So I've gone over a number of different interventions, a number of different techniques that can incorporate mindfulness. There are also self-guided material, or material that you can use yourself to help introduce these topics or help incorporate, increase, or combat our mind. There are two books, one by one called The Mindfulness Way Through Depression and Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life. One's focused with ACT and one's focused on mindfulness, or MBCT. I also printed out a number of handouts or flyers that, if you want to pick up at the end, has some of this. You don't have to write this down right now. There are also some apps or websites that can be helpful to find groups or find practitioners. Focus on just mindfulness by itself, focus on different mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or ACT practitioners. And with the advent of apps, you know, there's so many apps out there that you can use to incorporate mindfulness. One that, you know, I hear the most about is Calm.com. I have no stake in the company, but has been very effective for some people that I see. The important thing about these apps is I often hear that you can easily download it and use it for a week and then, you know, kind of forget about it. But part of what can be helpful is to incorporate something in a small way in one's everyday practice. And as I mentioned, there's interventions by mental health practitioners for MBCT, ACT, DBT, as well as there's many yoga and Tai Chi classes that are in the greater Boston area. So some of my final thoughts are be patient with yourself. Our minds are geared to protect ourselves. You know, our greatest source of strength is also a great source of suffering. And it takes time to change the way our minds are geared to do. Not one thing works for everybody. So it's finding what works for you. You know, some people might benefit from yoga, whereas others could really benefit from ACT or MBCT. And you can also consider this as something you can do in addition to what you might currently be doing. For example, medications or therapy. One can also add on going to a yoga or a Tai Chi class if they're able, or start to read some books or use apps. So that's my talk for you. You know, I'm really eager to open it up to questions. But thank you so much for listening.
Can you hear me? Thank you so much for the presentation. We actually had a Tai Chi.
I saw that on the website. Yeah.
Practitioner here, which was great. I sort of had a comment, and you know, just to share. I find that that my mind is so powerful. The thoughts that sometimes I feel like I can't even control it. Like I'll be intentional about trying to be in the present and focusing on where I am and focusing on the breath, and almost imperceptibly I'm back in thought again. Mm-hmm. You know, either what's going to happen, what happened, decisions that need to be made, decisions that have been made, and I just want, and then I sort of get frustrated. One thing that I have found that is helpful to that is if I breathe and I listen to the breath, mm-hmm. and sometimes that listening to the breath brings a sense of calm, and I almost feel like then I'll start to calm down, and I want that feeling of calmness, and that helps to sort of get back into it, you know.
Absolutely. And I also, you know, I hear this a lot where the mind kind of automatically goes back to what it does best, which is, you know, ruminating or worrying about different things. Now, what can also happen is being very judgmental of oneself for then your mind going back to that, which can be really hard because that is actually what we're geared to do. I would argue that that's our kind of default mode, which is to go to those thoughts and have our minds race. Almost like a physical metaphor of that, if our minds are constantly doing this, thinking about things that are going on in our life, planning, you can think about a grocery store, and instead of food, there's different thoughts, and we have you know hundreds of thoughts to choose from. And you know, one metaphor would be to identify this stream of thought, and then instead of trying to change or stop our thoughts, it's to choose the ones that we want to live our life by, or by the thoughts that we really want to live our life by. So it's different than trying to change our thoughts or change the way we think, but to be mindful that our minds are always doing this. And we might have some choice or develop an ability to have a choice in which ones that we want to live our life by.
I'd like to add something.
And
about the comment that you had made about despair, and I think that's a really great comment. It just made me think about the main point sort of mindfulness is that wherever we are in the moment, we want to observe it non-judgmentally. So it's kind of like, we're observing, you know, that moment of despair and pain and not sort of judging whether it's good or it's bad or it feels any way. It's just kind of it is, and we're observing that. And I think it's used like that with like chronic pain. People say to you, just like observe the pain and you don't judge whether it's good or it's bad. It's just sort of like non-judgmentally noticing it. So I wonder. Mm-hmm.
I just want to add something to Lucia's point. Actually, that's a good thing, that if your mind is wandering, because that's the moment of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
When you realize, you're aware, you have a cognition that your mind is drifting, so that's the moment of mindfulness, that's something normal and good.
And the moment is when she's noticing that her mind is wandering. Exactly, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
I appreciate your comment. I was thinking of it because I've done meditation, insight meditation. I spent 6 weeks at the Providence Zen Center. I've been at Barry Mass for the insight meditation. That there's a way in which I think if you attach with mindfulness with the intent and purpose of detaching from judgment and feeling, is that essentially what that is?
It is, yeah. So it's that present moment focus, non-judgmental stance, here and now. So it's all of that wrapped into one.
But detachment via attachment in some ways. It's an odd method.
It could be, yeah, if I'm getting you right, yeah.
Okay,
can I ask you, Paul? I remember at the beginning of your presentation, you were talking about fight or flight, and you were talking about prehistoric ancestors. How they would have to try to negotiate their environment, which is different than ours. One of the ways our environment is different is that we've all been trained. We've all gone to school. And I wonder if the kind of mastery you develop over your brain, all of us,
mm-hmm.
in order to learn to read and do science and history and all the rest of that, all this right brain stuff,
mm-hmm.
that maybe our prehistoric ancestors didn't have that training. So you said like our default mode is to water, but maybe that's not default. Maybe that's just a reaction to a training that's so ubiquitous we don't even notice it. And I was just wondering if mindfulness could actually make it hard for you to do your job as an accountant, for example, or, you know, do abstract thinking. It's just a thought I've always wondered about, if it's all good or there needs to be some balance.
Well, I guess some of the point is that, it's not making the claim whether one's good or bad. But I think, it's an interesting thought that we're training our brains to think abstractly. We're not doing things with our hands, or some people are, but we're not living to survive in that sense. So there is this training on how to delay gratification or think about future needs with at the expense of the now. So I think there is a component where this needs to, make sense in your life. However you might use this, for some people this could be a very big change, and you can make very different choices. Or some people it could be a small change, and an additional component that really could be helpful.
Well, just speaking just for one second again to this question of when you're enduring suffering, and a lot of Buddhist literature will talk about suffering as being something that we attempt to avoid, but that is inherent in life. So that for us, for those of us that suffer maybe out of proportion to what we think we deserve, the idea is to draw away from that judgment again, and to, when you are suffering, simply experience that and observe it, and also recognize that as everything in life does, it will change. And that flow that you're talking about, that has to do with lack of, decreasing resistance to what you're experiencing. And so whether that's good or bad, you allow that thing to come and go. You don't reject it, and you don't hold on to it either. So I found the last time that I dealt with a severe spell of depression this winter, that was a very helpful thing to be able to step away from the suffering. Mm-hmm.
In some ways, the more work we push against that vulnerability, the more the vulnerability is right below the surface, the more we can develop a stance of trying to let it go, the more it will let us be.
Yeah.
But that's a hard... It's hard to wrap our mind around that concept, because we really don't want to feel these ways, and we're trying to push this away.
And it is a practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something also, I think, that there is discipline in it. So it's not something that you just immediately know how to do. It's actually something you have to work at. And I was wondering if you know anything about IFS and how that might relate to mindfulness.
I don't know anything. I don't know that term.
Internal family systems. It's a model of therapy that focuses on identifying parts of oneself that might have been developed over the years in reaction, basically as coping mechanisms, and how becoming aware and having the higher self that is separate from those, and observing those parts coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And identifying them and accepting them radically, that actually helps you to create a more healthy inner dialogue around parts that we might have identified as being bad or good, and that might be actually holding us back from integration and focusing on what the present moment holds.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of overlap in terms of the non-judgmental stance, the goal of shifting our attentional awareness or attentional focus, the here and now. So it sounds like there's some overlap. I'm not familiar with that.
It's very interesting. That intervention.
And something that was also highlighted is this kind of concept of the human experience, which is, there is suffering involved in the human experience. And, part of trying to develop a tolerance or understanding that's a part of our lives, and how to work with that in a different way.
Someone told me one time that mindfulness isn't great for people with trauma, and I was wondering what you thought about that.
So mindfulness, it can be hard, especially with the focus on one's thoughts, can bring about memories of kind of trauma history. I wouldn't think that it is contraindicated, so that it can't be helpful, but it just might be a little bit harder. And I think that speaks to the point here, is that it is something that takes practice. It's almost like a muscle, a mindfulness muscle, to work against the way that our minds are geared to. But it's not something that's insurmountably difficult. It's accessible conceptually and to do it. There's a lot of resources that can help kind of increase one's knowledge of it and stance with it. Sometimes it can be done, by yourself with self-help books or different types of readings. But oftentimes it can be helpful to have a mental health practitioner involved to help guide one through the process.
I just wanted to contribute one point. I used to go to the Cambridge Insight Meditation mm-hmm. Center for a period of time. And one of the things that may help get started in this process is one of the things they mentioned there was you may not be able to do one thing at a time or focus on one thing at a time, but if you're going to focus on five things at a time, just focus on five things at a time and so on from there to kind of get you started on the path.
I think that's a great point. Many people might not have seen this, but one of the cartoons was a person with a lot of kind of things harrowing them, a lot of like life tasks or things that one might need. And this doesn't get rid of those. What you need to do might still be there, but your relationship with what those are can be a little bit different. Or to focus on whatever you're doing fully as opposed to focusing on 100 other things. Okay.
So I
well, thank you.
Question.
Oh, yeah.
something that I'm working on now, primarily because I'm a single parent of a 20-year-old daughter, and it's a lot of work, is to learn how to be responsive and not reactive.
Mm-hmm.
So when I experience something, or when something happens to me, to instead of having the impulse right away to just react without thinking,
mm-hmm.
I don't even really want to be thinking at all. I want to sort of wait and sort of hang back a little bit, experience what's happening, and then respond in some way. It feels to me that it's related to what you're talking about in that CBT, the mindfulness CBT.
It very much does. It's that it seems like your pull is to not go with that quick kind of reaction, but to kind of sit with the experience and then develop a different relationship with it so that you can make maybe a choice most consistent with how you want to react as opposed to kind of reacting based on our emotional response. And I'm also hearing that you also want to respond in a way that kind of validates your daughter's experience and explain maybe your reasoning as well, so it can be both in the same kind of the same token or same way.
I like how you said have a different relationship with it, because it certainly comes up a lot with my daughter, but it really more and more comes up everywhere mm-hmm. in my life. I tend to want to just respond or react right mm-hmm. away. And I like that idea of creating a different relationship mm-hmm. with the situation so that I can respond yeah. in a healthier way. Thank you. Yeah,
I'm sorry, you were behind the
There was a recent book called A Truckload of Money that was basically about one of the directors of Kayak.com. And one of the elements of it is he was diagnosed bipolar but used meditation in lieu of medication. How do you feel about that? It seems to be working very well.
Yeah, based on where I work and what I'm interested or focused on is depression. But MBCT or mindfulness has been translated to bipolar disorder as well. And, there's beginning to have evidence that this can also be quite helpful for both, the down times, but also the up times too. It's incorporating mindfulness just in a little bit different way. So I think perhaps that can be helpful. I mean, it doesn't get at your other question on whether one's better than the other. And I don't think there is one answer to that question. For some people, that might be helpful, but for others, that might not be helpful.
Hi there. I think when people come here to the hospital to start getting into recovery, the big question is, I have to do something about the stress level. Mm-hmm. I think these exercises are very good to getting to the part where I can have a productive life, but with a stress level that's manageable. Do you think that's right?
That's a great point. Yeah, I mean, I think that part of this is developing a different relationship with the events that are going on in your life can be helpful for distress tolerance. There's a lot of different skills or different techniques to reduce one's reactivity or to have a different relationship with, you know, what's going on. So it could be a good first step, or it could be an additional step. That's a great point.
I found leading hikes up in, guided hikes up in Maine, and you know, we were reading animal tracks, which was a good thing. But what I notice is the adults are like lost in thought while they're on the trail, and it's the children that spot all the wildlife. And I wish I had what those children had.
I think that's a great point. I think in at least some practices, there's something called child's mind, or where we can really see the world as we once did without all of the worries or life difficulties that we grow into in adulthood. Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being here.